going to have one more great presentation, this time from Dennis Rooney, 1959. How many of you were born after that? The first full year of the stereo LP. Dennis Rooney joined ARSC in 1996 and has served on its technical committee. His reviews of books and recordings regularly appear in the ARSC Journal, and he has been a regular presenter at these conferences. A professional career embracing journalism, classical record production, broadcasting, and narration has been accompanied by nearly six decades as a record collector. Discs from his collection are frequently used in CD historical reissues. As both a producer and archival catalog exploitation consultant to the classical recording industry, he developed and contributed to important classical reissue lines for Sony Classical, including the award-winning Masterworks Heritage Historical Reissues, Universal Classics, where he planned and produced the 10 CD set Steinway Legends in cooperation with Steinway and Sons of 2006, I guess that's what, and Vox. He also conceived and produced a 12 CD set of historical and broadcast recordings issued by the Minnesota Orchestra to celebrate its 2003 centennial. His writings on music have regularly appeared in the Strad for a quarter century. He has also contributed to BBC Music Magazine, Musical Times, Classical Record Collector, Musical America, and International Musical America International Directory, and MusicalAmerica.com. In addition to previous affiliation with Minnesota Public Radio and New York's WQXR-FM, he has recorded more than 100 titles for the Talking Books, administered by LC's National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Just think, I used to work for the Library for the Blind in my early career before I became a librarian, so kind of got this little extra touch. Now I present to you Dennis Rooney.
Thank you, Bill. Just waiting for my magic advance machine. There it is.
Is this yours or not?
This is what I'm using.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Nothing else up here.
Okay. David wasn't first home.
Last year marked the 50th anniversary of the appearance of stereo LPs. But the interest in and adoption of the new medium really took off the following year. To celebrate, I gathered a baker's dozen audio cuts and pored over the pages of High Fidelity and Hi-Fi Review, among others, to find interesting display ads to bring to you via PowerPoint. Given the brevity of the available time, I have made no attempt. That's a little close. When it rings, it's too close. Sorry about that. I have made no attempt at a comprehensive overview, just an assortment of sounds and images I hope you'll find entertaining. Despite having existed since 1931, stereo audio did not become practical until magnetic tape recording became common after World War II. Stereo tape recorders appeared in the early 50s. Emery Cook in the 50s issued some LPs about 1954-55 in a special binaural format where two channels were cut adjacently on a disc and played back with a jigged double pickup. However, the only successful commercial exploitation of stereo up to 1958 had been via pre-recorded magnetic tape introduced in 1954 on two-track tape that revolved at 7.5 inches per second. It was an audiophile sub-item, and its expense, in addition to the problems and rituals associated with a longitudinal medium, deterred wide-scale adoption. A stereo LP meant both a cheaper and more convenient way to hear stereo. Of course, the first thing the consumer had to do was acquire another loudspeaker and the associated amplification to reproduce the stereo signal, which might take some saving, even given the more than favorable cost-to-income ratios for audio gear in those days. But you could get into stereo discs fairly economically by replacing a mono cartridge with a stereo one. As these advertisements from the pages of the monthly magazines High Fidelity and Hi-Fi Review show. The Westrex system of stereo mastering proved a success, although signal-to-noise ratios were poorer than mono LPs, and channel separation was often minimal compared to tape. Nevertheless, directionality was a novelty that led to the release of many sound effects records, such as our first three examples. And Big Ben gave away the last location, which was Parliament Square in London at 11 o'clock in the evening. The early stereo releases that featured hard left and right effects within the musical program later came to be called ping pong stereo, and here is a typical example.
Thank you.
And we can see Ralph Bellamy sitting somewhere in the Alps, I guess, listening to his stereo rig. Although labeled full-dimensional stereo, this capital release of Meredith Willson and his wife, Renee, performing a recreation of a backer's audition for The Music Man is nothing of the sort. It is, in fact, a monophonic recording assigned to left and right channels rather randomly. If you listen to the whole disc, the piano keeps shifting from the left to right as one number ends and another begins.
Well, down the street, Miss Mary is sitting on her front porch, and she is confessing her love for this gentleman, Professor Hill, to the moonlight, but, of course, inadvertently to us in the audience.
Dream of now, dream of then, dream of a love so that might have been. Do I love you? Oh, yes, I love you. And I'll bravely tell you, but only when. Sweet and low, sweet and low, how sweet that memory how long ago, forever, oh yes, forever, will I ever tell you.
Down the street comes the barbershop quartet. It happens to be a lamppost in front of Miss Mary's house, so the inevitable will happen.
Dream of now,
to get the sun back in my sky.
Dream of home
again, rose about a thousand
miles from shore.
When the chips are down, tape's still king, says Sony Superscope. And that's the first Sony ad I was able to find in the pages of those magazines. This recording by Morton Gould and his orchestra has some stereo effect, but it's highly gimmicky. Listen to the unnatural prominence of the instrumental solos, especially the xylophone, and how they move around. It took a while before the real benefits of stereophony, depth, what later was described as soundstage, and imaging were appreciated for how they enriched the experience of listening to works with distinct directional properties, such as Bartók's music for strings, percussion, and celesta, so clearly delineated in Fritz Reiner's classic recording with the Chicago Symphony and Orchestra Hall. ¶¶ Competing methods of stereo miking were hotly debated. One faction, and I remain a member, favored using a single stereo differential microphone to record an orchestra. An example is this excerpt from Petrushka, issued on a 1959 Omega disc, a label that began as Omega Tape, a purveyor of pre-recorded tape. A Neumann SM2 was used. The Decca Record Company in England released its catalog on the London label in the United States until only a few years ago. Its recording techniques have been extensively described by fellow ARSC member Mike Gray and others. Decca's multi-mic stereo setups have consistently achieved outstanding results. This recording of the Halfter Sinfonietta, released in the early months of 1959, is entirely satisfying despite its vintage. Mercury's C. Robert Fine, who preferred using a single microphone for monophonic recording, used a pair of widely spaced omnidirectional microphones for stereo. His so-called semi-purist technique, whose results were hailed when they were first released, has held its own for half a century, as this 1959 release shows. Another Mercury recording made in the Eastman Theater became a bestseller. look at some vintage cartridges and amplifiers there. United Artists and Everest were just two of the labels that jumped into stereo in 1959, as Angel finally got into it too. And Columbia came very late to stereo. "You want it again?" said Bruno Walter. And Edward van Beinum, an outstanding Dutch conductor, dropped dead in April of 1959. Only a few stereo records in his discography. Westminster, since its founding in 1950, had become one of the most respected American independent labels. They began recording stereophonically in 1956 and achieved outstanding results in London in a series made for the English Nixa label. What happened here? Sorry, just a minute. There. One of which is this music of Britain, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. At Le Pavillon. Wonderful stuff. The final recorded example in this show and tell was the most important release of 1959 and perhaps the most decisive spur to widespread adoption of stereo playback systems. In June, London released their widely anticipated recording of Das Rheingold, the only one of Wagner's Ring Cycle to have previously gone unrecorded in its entirety. John Coleshaw, the recording's producer, has written extensively on the project and how it was specifically planned for stereo recording. If you haven't read Ring Resounding, I recommend it highly. Meanwhile, imagine, if you can, what it meant to a generation of Wagner enthusiasts used to listening to abridged 78 RPM and live performance recordings of doubtful audio quality on LP to hear a realization of Wagner's intentions in a medium he could never have imagined. Since there's time for only a taste, we begin where Donner is about to strike his hammer to bring the Rainbow Bridge and Valhalla into view.
Thank you.
As the months passed by, the word of mouth spread until, by the end of 1959, Das Rheingold sales had surpassed all expectations and were even approaching pop numbers. As we know, the Schulte Ring, of which this was the first installment, has never been out of the catalog during the ensuing half century. This conflation of audio examples and accompanying ads brought me into close contact with a simpler time. Immersion in the original magazines brought at least a temporary entree to what was my 19th year, which I remember, but not in the precise detail that emerged from my perusal of their now rapidly acidifying pages. One thing I had never realized before is how many recordings issued in that year, 1959, became acknowledged classics and have continued to be available. My pack rat tendencies, so regularly denounced by my wife, served me well in this instance. How fortunate I was never to dispose of those magazines, so I didn't have to search their pages on microfilm or argue with some librarian about bending pages to scan them. After all, what good is it if it can't be used? Thanks to Seth Winter, Al Lisitsky, Mike Shields, Larry King, and Eric Johnson for their assistance in loaning original material and preparing this presentation. Thank you very much.